Down to Business with Bobby Kerr.
Brought to you by Bank of Ireland
on News Talk.
So we better get on with the business at hand. Welcoming for our paper and news business news review this morning. Delighted to welcome Louisa Meehan of Woodview HRM and indeed Stephen O'Leary, the founder of Oletico. Stephen, we'll start with you. Employers, the Irish Examiner, is telling us are winning the hybrid work revolution. Tell me more.
Yeah, this is Eimear Walsh writing in the business section of the Irish Examiner today. And I'm not sure I would agree about it being a competition between employers and employees, but certainly she does raise some really interesting points and has a couple of excellent interviews with both Tracy Keevans, the global FDI director at Morgan McKinley, and Elle McConnelly, the hub manager in Ludgate. And you get those, I suppose, kind of two both kind of local and international perspectives here. Ultimately, you know, some of these things aren't surprising. So the number of people working mainly from home has risen by 173% if we take the numbers going back as far as 2016. And that's based on CSO data. But I think what the article really brings home is that while we saw a huge change during COVID and we went fully remote for a long time, and as people started to return to the office, there was still that skew or that stronger skew towards working from home. Increasingly, some employers, certainly in larger organizations, are looking for their staff to come in more frequently. And some of the reasons being cited, I think, are fair, right? So that idea of training and education and the passing on of knowledge, the things that are maybe easier to do in person. But I think in other cases, there are other reasons too. This kind of like trust around employees and what they're doing on those crucial Monday and Friday days.
Yeah. Louisa, I know this is your area of expertise per se. What I'm hearing is that the age profile of the problematic, I never want to be in the office again, is between 30 and 50, i.e., somebody who maybe is on the career path, has a relatively stable job, but really has seen that maybe some wasted years travelling to and from an office, seen the benefits of this new release of being able to bring kids to school or whatever else it entails, and really has no interest in ever going back to the office unless they're dragged back.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the point around new entrants and the training and education and knowledge transfer is really important. And we definitely see that. But as you're saying, when you hit that sort of 30 plus mark and you know your job, that importance sort of is less important to you, and your time, your flexibility, your opportunity to live your life is increasingly important. And, you know, for every single person on the planet, the only one thing that we can get no more of is time. It is limited. We don't know in what way. You know, in the article, they talk about the importance of flexible working for women. And I think we need to be really careful when we're talking about flexibility for women and it being a women's issue. And for sure, the lack of flexibility does limit access to work and progression within work for women, perhaps more than men. But I think men and women have both benefited possibly equally from the flexibility that's been there. And what I've certainly seen both in my personal life and, you know, peers and within the workplaces is it's almost had a bigger impact for men, because now you have dads who are in full time, important, you know, demanding jobs, being able to work from home 2, 3, 4, 5 days a week. So they're still doing their work. They're still doing their however many hours it is, 40 plus hours. But they're there in the morning for breakfast. They're there in the evening for dinner. They can have lunch with their kids in the afternoon. If the kids are doing homework and it's like, go talk to your dad about that, and they're not on a call or they're not in a meeting, they can take 10 minutes. They can have the conversations. Yeah. And it's a better life.
The paragraph that stands out in this piece for me is a recent survey from Employer Flex indicated that all things being equal, 92% of employees would move from their current role for more flexibility in another position. 92%.
Well, Bobby,
that's 9 out of 10 people.
My first job was just outside London, more than one decade ago, nearly 2 decades ago more. And I remember somebody I was working with who was in that 30 plus age bracket, hoping on having a family. She left a job in central London and came to work. I was in Dartford in Kent, so just sort of the similar to being just outside the M50, that sort of distance. And she took, at that point in time, over a £10,000 sterling cut in salary to be in a position where she was in a job that was within 20 minutes of where she lived and stopped commuting. So this isn't new.
My final piece on this, Stephen, is that we see here, and their businesses are quoted in this article, Meta, Facebook, Zoom, all big corporate giants saying, we need you back in the office. So somebody knows something. So there's that elephant in the room that the big guys know that maybe the guy is doing a little bit more than dropping the kids to school.
Well, it's good news for a smaller employer like us.
Yeah.
Right? So Olitico is a micro business and we compete for talent against those companies you just listed, right? We're in the same pool looking for the same kind of talent. And what we can do is we can offer much greater flexibility. So in a way, if the bigger companies are coming in and stipulating you got to be in 3, 4, or 5 days a week, smaller businesses can use that as a point of difference.
Yeah. I think we're probably, and I know this has been discussed, but we probably are going to, this will be monetized eventually. And I think there'll be a rate, now maybe in a broad sense, a rate whereby maybe that you just won't earn as much if you, there'll be maybe a price to pay. And, you know, maybe that's okay.
And we've seen, again, that's not new either. So London Waiting is probably the most famous example of that, where you got a salary that was at a different level if you lived within London at certain times. I think you're going to see the same kind of thing that, you know, if your job involves you actually being in the office more frequently, well, then maybe you're entitled to a higher rate of pay.
Well, we have you there, Stephen. Two battlegrounds emerging over the cost of Irish unification. Cliff Taylor here, a really good piece from him. But really, pick any number you like.
Kind of, yeah. So this is, like you say, this is Cliff Taylor in the Irish Times today. And what I suppose has spurred this on or brought it to the top of the agenda is a paper from two economists at the IIEA this week who have, I guess, kind of speculated or are certainly set out that the cost of this to the Irish exchequer could be in the region of 20 billion euros a year. Now, there's lots of different numbers set out in this piece. And there's also, I guess, kind of other estimates from other organizations. So, for example, a more optimistic view from the University of British Columbia predicts that actually there could be gains, that actually there could be gains of tens of billions of euros to be made. But there, it comes down to two key things. It feels like there are two key things at the center of this. It is increasing public pay rates in the north to match those in the Republic, which is estimated at costing 10 billion euros.
Staggering, isn't it?
Yeah. And there's also the question of pensions and who would fund it. But Taylor makes the point that this isn't cut and dry. That when this occurs, and he says when, not if, that it will be a negotiation. And that critically, that's what this will come down to. That it's not like one side will absolutely pay something and another side will pay another. That this will be a negotiated process.
Yeah, I think reading the article, you know, it kind of unfurls the complexity of it for me. I didn't really think about it, but looking at this article, this is a massively complex thing. And the numbers, as you say, depend on who you talk to, could be. And so there's a lot of ifs and buts.
There is. I think one of the interesting things that Taylor says is that he feels that voters in the Republic won't choose unification if it comes with a 10 or 20 billion euro annual cost. I think that's an interesting point to make. I wonder, is there a cost? And I think that's one of the things that's going to be explored. And Taylor says this, that this is almost a starting point, that he expects a lot more research to be done into this issue of what this unification will cost.
Louisa, some accounts out from the VHI this morning, recording a loss of 43.4 million. And that's despite rising premiums. So I look through these figures, it's quite interesting.
It is really interesting. And when you look at it, as you say, the premiums are increasing by around 3.2%. The number of customers have increased by 37,000. They have 1.7 million customers across all of their different products that they have on offer. The issue that they're having is that claims increased by around 18% is what they're saying. And they've also had the additional increases in costs in terms of labour, energy costs, all the business costs that every other business has had out there. But the real impact here, and actually the real story within this, is an increase in 2023, a significant increase in demand for healthcare as a result of healthcare that was maybe held back during the pandemic for whatever reason, and people going out and saying, okay, now I'm going to sort myself out. I find it quite interesting as being somebody who the first half of last year availed of lots of VHI claims for various healthcare issues. But we've certainly seen an increase in demand. We're seeing an increase in claims. It has become easier to make a claim, I had to put a claim in just yesterday for through their multi-trip travel insurance for something that happened last week. It was a 5-minute phone call. It was really easy. I sort of came off the call going, well, that seemed too easy. Wow. How can you do it? So,
Stephen, I look at a lot of figures, you know, and analysing business results and that. I'm always intrigued by, you know, year-on-year comparisons. When you look at this business here, the company recorded a net loss of $43.4 million. But that's compared to a net profit of $34.3 million the previous year. Like, that's a big seesaw.
It is. Now, I think we have to remember the impact of COVID.
Yeah,
I think that is central here. To your point, Bobby, one of the standout numbers for me is the near parity in the amount they took in premiums and paid out in claims.
So yeah,
Pope makes the point that it's $1.68 billion in premiums and $1.68 billion paid out in claims, like a near exact number. And I suppose the other point to note is that as a business and as an employer, there is good news in here. This is the 9th consecutive year of growth in membership. So while definitely they've swung from a profit to a loss, there is good news within this too.
Yeah, okay. I know I don't want to oversimplify it. It's a complex business and anything dealing with claims and all that. The National Broadcaster has found its way into the papers again today, Louisa. Let's look at some of the HR issues, let's call them, because the Broadcaster is advertising 2 new senior roles, and this is despite a hiring freeze at the station.
Yeah, look, I see a few HR issues in here, and I think it must be a tricky situation. So they're hiring at the minute for the director of audio and director of video. Both appear to be new roles, replacing a single role, which is the head of content, held by Jim Jennings, who's named in the article and has been on sick leave for the last year. You know, a lot of information out there in relation to an employee. So they're hiring in 2 senior individuals to replace a senior individual who still is in employment. And that does raise some red flags or concerns. You know, why you need 2 roles to replace 1, and how you can replace somebody on a permanent basis, because I checked and they are permanent replacements that they're putting in place for that individual who's still in employment. They have currently 7 vacancies. So they do, as you say, have a recruitment freeze. But what they have said is that in exceptional circumstances where the business is demanding it, that they can do recruitment. So these roles are seen as being in exceptional circumstances. They have 7 current vacancies. So anybody out there looking to work at RTE, if you're an administrator in the broadcast engineer, live production, media operator or wardrobe assistant, then they have some vacancies for you.
Right. Stephen, you know, this drip stuff that keeps damaging RT, let's call it. There's 2 independent reports into HR issues and governance at RT that are awaited. We still haven't seen them. So there's going to be more stuff in there. And we're going to be talking about it probably in 3 weeks' time on this show. And, you know, it's just this endless drip of, you know, of things that effectively culturally and otherwise damaged the organisation.
Yeah, I mean, look, there was a long build-up here over a prolonged period of time in terms of this story, and it's going to take a long time for it to wash out too. I think one of the key things in terms of the job descriptions that stood out for me here was strong commercial and financial acumen. And I think there really is probably a premium on that. And I would imagine what the Director General now is looking at is, in terms of these roles, is the return on the investment. When you're bringing in 2 people to replace 1, I think you can make a case for that if the people coming in are going to drive revenue.
Yeah.
And that is absolutely critical.
But they're creative positions.
Yeah.
Well, they are, but they do specify that commercial and financial acumen. So I think if they bring in people who've got that and can deliver that, then I think that will probably be a key marker here in terms of whether this is a successful hiring.
Yeah. Interesting. There's a lot of talk about EVs, electric vehicles, across a lot of platforms. And I just picked out a couple of them that we might talk about. The first one is from Adrian Weckler in today's Irish Independent, who owns an electric vehicle. And he says, which is quite a startling headline, as an EV owner, it's easy to see why sales are falling. Now, that's not what you want. If you're selling EVs, that's not the kind of testimony that you want to be reading about in this morning's newspaper.
It's not. And yet, if you follow Weckler on social media, you will know from his kind of very active X account and others that this is a topic he talks about a lot. He obviously is an EV owner, and this is not new news. So we've, you know, this trend in terms of electric vehicles has been there now for the last 6 to 9 months. I suppose it's very top of mind in the last couple of weeks, particularly with the Tesla announcements, amongst others, more broadly. But what I like about Weckler's piece is you are hearing it from an owner's point of view and some of those practical implications. And critically, while there are criticisms of electric vehicles, he says that he is happy to have one, would buy another one, and also presents a solution. So he sets out that the key thing that the government need to do is to facilitate more public charging points, and that they're not doing it quickly enough, but that if that happened, it would have an immediate impact on range anxiety in particular.
Yeah. No, I immediately resonated with this as an electric vehicle owner myself. And I do exactly the same things that he does, which is, number one, when I'm going over to the Cliffs of Moher and I know I'm going to be there, I say, you know what? I'm going to take my daughter's car, and I'm quite happy to take it if she lend it to me, on the basis that I don't want to be stopping and building in the 45 minutes. Now, I won't do that every time, but I'll do it if I'm under pressure or I don't want any complications. So the second thing he says, Louisa, which is really, really telling, is, you know, the depreciation factor. In 1 year, his car, now, I again, you know, has gone from a valuation 42,000 to 25,000.
Yeah, I mean, it's a huge
like that's a wipeout.
It is, and it negates any cost savings that he's had, and probably goes beyond that.
Yeah.
So you know, the range anxiety and the overall cost of buying it in the first place, and then maintaining in terms of
maintaining
in terms of the depreciation.
Yeah, yeah,
is huge. And that range anxiety that you talk about, like, I have younger children. So for me, getting home is always critical. So I don't have an electric vehicle because I don't have an extra 40 minutes on long journeys, and I do a lot of long journeys.
Yeah. I really love my electric car, and I'm a kind of an a la carte user, which is maybe not a good thing in the sense that, and I'm fortunate enough that my daughter, as I say, is happy to lend me my car or her car, as long as it doesn't come back with any cross on crumbs or anything.
Do you
like
give
that
her your car there when you're gone?
Just in relation to that, Stephen, just a couple of other little hits. The EV slowdown. Battery maker LG, again, they're reporting trouble. So this is all linked there. And also, which I didn't know, this company, Ubercity, I'm probably saying that wrong, pulls the plug on Ireland. Again, this is a company, an international company with 10,000 charging points worldwide. They were doing some pilot runs, I think, in Malahide and Castleknock with Fingal, but they say that they're exiting Ireland. These are all little things that are bad news for the positivity around electric vehicles.
And the problem is it has that cumulative effect, right? Yeah. So you read Weckler's piece and you're like, oh God, that seems like a lot of depreciation. You read this piece in the Irish Times and you're like, gosh, that's going to be harder to charge my car. You know, these mount. And when you're trying to make a purchasing decisions, all of these things come together in terms of kind of making it more difficult to pick the EV.
Next on, we have, we haven't that much time. So why don't we go and talk about Temple Bar? Because this is really, there's something happening in a shop in Temple Bar. It's around for 64 years, Louisa. And it's called Rory's Fishing Tackle. And it's just a lovely, lovely story about how a different type of business in a kind of a curious location can be just such a fantastic thing.
Look, I'll own up straight away. I don't like fishing. This involves, you know, selling of maggots and worms and all kinds of other really icky things. And yet I'm kind of looking at this going, I'm going to go to Temple Bar and see what this shop is like. Because it's a small family run business, they talk about the importance of having those unique businesses and having them, you know, be maintained. So the individual here, Mary Harkin, has worked in this business for her whole life. Her father set it up 64 years ago, as you said, and she has been there probably for longer than she can remember, and they still have basically the same fundamental business. Yeah. And Amy Winehouse was a past customer and bought a t-shirt in there which said, let me just find the quote here. If you want to be happy for a day, get drunk for a week, get married for life and go fishing.
Yeah.
So apparently this t-shirt's really good.
Stephen, are you a fisherman?
I'm not, but 20 years ago when I was in college, I worked in Temple Bar waiting tables in restaurants, and I used to pass Rory's every day on my way into the restaurant, and it was one of those places that always stood out, right? So different to maybe the stereotype of what Temple Bar is like. And these kind of family businesses are what you need. You know, we talk a lot about the high street and diversity
yeah.
on it.
Yeah.
You know, it's so different to what you expect. And it's great. This piece from Amy Dunne, who's a lovely profile, and I hope it leads to a yeah. business for them.
And we need more of those. God knows we need more of them. Finally, good nudes. John Lowe is telling us in the Mail today that fine art can help you make huge piles of cash. And he cites a couple of interesting examples, Louisa.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, look, he's talking about, I'm definitely going to get this wrong, a piece of art called Sur les Côtes-Couches that was bought by John Magner in 2003 for $27 million and sold 6 years ago in Sotheby's for $157 million.
There you go.
You know, you don't have to be good at maths to know that that's a decent profit.
481% return.
Yeah, you need to know what you're doing though. So if you're investing in art, they do suggest checking your attic, but I wouldn't be going out spending $27 million unless you know what you're doing first.
Last quick word to you, Stephen.
Yeah, I mean, he does give some more accessible options too, like stamp collecting or rock and roll memorabilia. So, you know, it doesn't have to be the 27 million euro painting you start with.
All right, you heard it here, folks. Louisa Meehan and Stephen O'Leary, thanks for a great business review.
Down to Business with Bobby Kerr.
Brought to you by Bank of Ireland.
Saturday morning at 11 on News Talk.